How much do national borders define a culture? Ross Perlin suggests that we follow the languages to get at what really sets one society apart from another.
The linguistic map is the deeper one that really gets you into European history, European culture.
Coming up, we'll look at where the words we speak came from. As a woman of color who often travels solo, Onika Raymond wants to encourage everyone to get excited about traveling in other cultures.
I think it's really important for all of us to be a good neighbor as we make the world our oyster and as we navigate all these different places, spaces, and destinations.
She also lets us in on the issues that black travelers often have to face.
People have a certain idea in their mind of who I am, where I'm from, and what my intentions are.
And listeners share more stories on how they're avoiding being overwhelmed by tourist crowds in Europe. Come along for the hour ahead. It's Travel with Rick Steves. A host of budget travel shows tells us what her priorities are as a black woman who often travels solo. And we'll check with more listeners on how they're avoiding the crowds at popular tourist sites now that the whole world is traveling again. That's in the hour ahead on today's Travel with Rick Steves. Europe is home to about 24 official languages and many more regional ones that may still be spoken today. While languages die out all the time, knowing how one language became dominant over the others can help you understand the history and character of any society. And it can help you notice when the minority languages start to make a comeback. Joining us is Dr. Ross Perlin. He teaches linguistics at Columbia University and co-founded the nonprofit Endangered Language Alliance. They help document, map, and preserve languages that are at risk of disappearing. He joins us from his office in New York City. Ross, thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Rick.
You know, I'm just fascinated by a linguist, and a lot of us don't really appreciate or understand what a linguist does. Tell us, what is a linguist?
I wish it was somebody who just got to learn languages, because I do love learning languages, and people always ask, oh, how many do you speak? But linguists also have a responsibility to think about language more broadly, research theories of language, try to understand principles of language more generally. And my particular specialty within it is endangered languages, especially of the Himalaya, but I've also worked in Europe and other places and have a base here in New York City, the most multilingual city in the history of the world, where languages come from all over.
And you just wrote a book called Language City, which is all about the fight to preserve endangered mother tongues in New York. Now, you mentioned that people ask you, how many languages do you speak? And I know that you've written that that's something that linguists do not like to be asked. Well, first of all, why not? And how many languages do you speak?
Well, I guess the reason why not is just because linguistics is about more than that. And it's not about just sort of enumerating and bagging languages. And as in my case, yes, I think I counted. I've studied, you know, 15 or something like that and right. Have varying degrees of knowledge of them. But like anybody, they come and go or I know them in different ways. So it's about language as part of lived experience, I think, is an important thing to remember.
I know from reading your book that there's new schools of linguistics and so on. And you're what I think would be called a radical linguist. The only other linguist I've ever known is, of course, Noam Chomsky. And you wrote kind of humorously that he's a radical, but he's not a radical linguist. what is the difference between your focus on linguistics and Chomsky's?
So, you know, Noam Chomsky, in terms of his linguistic work, which is pretty different in many ways from his political writings, comes along in the 1950s and 1960s and really changes the field with the sort of idea of searching for linguistic universals. And, of course, there's a lot more to it there. But it, by and large, sort of bypasses actually existing linguistic diversity and the imperative to document the, you know, more than half of the world's languages, which are little documented and are highly endangered. So the focus of the sort of, you could say, radical linguistics that I have been part of is really in the last couple of decades of stressing that actually this diversity is being lost. We need to really recognize and document all the differences and take them seriously and actually appreciate and celebrate that. And yes, where there are commonalities, we can look at those too, but those actually, in some cases, pale before the immense differences and fascinating different ways that we communicate with each other.
And talking about, you know, the fascinating history and story of languages as they relate to peoples and cultures, this is a travel show. I focus on Europe in my teaching, and Europe to me is just a fascinating story of bully tribes and weak tribes and pushing and pulling, and that would show itself today in the linguistic map of Europe.
if you were to look at the political map of Europe and the linguistic map of Europe, they would be different, wouldn't they?
Those are very different maps. And I think the linguistic map is the deeper one that really gets you into European history, European culture. You know, whether if you want to go to the Basque country, you go to the Dolomites, you go to Istria or any number of places. These are multilingual spaces where if you really want to understand what's going on, you need to understand who are the Basques? What is their language? What is the Ladin language that's spoken in some of those Dolomite and Alpine regions? You know, what is multilingual Istria? This is really the deeper view on what's happening. And it gets into the food, the dress, the music, but language is the lens.
I think when you look at Europe, there's like 24 official languages. There's five languages that really are dominant. I think there's five languages that are spoken by over 50 million people. But if you look at the little languages, which are a few of those that you find interesting as a linguist?
Well, one of the places I've worked in Europe is Istria, the Istrian Peninsula, which is part of Croatia, but very close to Italy. And it's one of the most multilingual places that I've been. Everybody's speaking four or five languages. And I worked there a little bit with what people know as the Italian community, which is considered by some, you know, sort of ethnically Italian, but actually speak a native language called Istrioto. And this is the original language of Istria. It's a Romance language, but pretty different maybe from some of the other ones you know. And then many speak Istro-Veneto, which is a dialect of the Venetian language, because Istria was under Venetian control for almost 1,000 years. And then on top of that, people may speak standard Italian too, because Istria did spend some time as part of Italy, and Italian was brought in, and there are ties there. And then, of course, there's Croatian, specifically the sort of Western dialects of Croatian, since this became part of Croatia. And, you know, of course, then there's English and German that people also speak, but that's just one example of how multilingual a place can be.
And that, is it a coincidence that that happens to be where three giant linguistic families come together? You got the Romance languages, you got the Germanic language, and you got the Slavic languages, right?
That's true. It is kind of a fulcrum, so it is a pretty unique place. And that's, you know, an important thing to remember is that, yeah, these language families interweave in such fascinating ways. You know, there are certain regions like the Balkans that linguists just love to look at because it represents a kind of meeting point as well of all these different languages and how they influence each other. And actually, even in a single language, you can see the grammar coming from different families.
And Ross, as a linguist, do you look at some languages that you just think, oh, yeah, barbarian hordes, you know, like Hungary, right? Hungary is just a weird language as far as what are the other languages around it. It's not related to any of these. And you can trace it back, and it was a bunch of nomadic warriors that eventually said, oh, this is a nice place. Let's settle down.
Yeah, the history of Hungarian is certainly a fascinating one. And of course, it then links you to the history of Finnish, right? These are related, Finnish and Hungarian and Estonian. And then if you look at what are the related languages, you're going deep into Russia. And there's a bunch of, you know, endangered, little known languages that are part of that same family. And so then to piece together that archipelago is to understand something pretty fundamental about, you know, European history, really Eurasian history. You sort of see those connections of Eurasia as a whole, which, you know, of course, Europe is this fascinating peninsula or world of Western Eurasia, but it's linked to all these other places as well. It's part of a global history.
Ross Perlin's our guest on Travel with Rick Steves as we look at how understanding the role of Europe's many languages can help you better appreciate its distinct cultures. Ross is the author of Language City, The Fight to Preserve Endangered Mother Tongues in New York. In it, he explores how New York is the most linguistically diverse city in history. Ross has also been co-director of the Endangered Language Alliance since 2013, where he manages projects on urban linguistic diversity. There's more about their work at elaalliance.org. Ross, I'm fascinated by the survival, frankly, of these small languages that are bullied by the big languages. And when we think in Europe, what are a couple of languages that are regional, that are not national languages, that you think are healthy?
Well, some of the best-known cases are Welsh, which has held on in northern Wales in amazing ways. In Spain, you're looking at Basque and Catalan in particular, which have stabilized and even mounted revivals. And there are other cases around as well. It's these stories are pretty amazing.
And those are hard-fought successes from a linguistic point of view. I mean, Catalonian people, they'll fall on their sword for their language. I mean, they were really brutalized by Franco, and now they can wave the Catalonian flag and they can speak their language at school and it can be the first language of that part of Spain.
Yeah, it's really the story of Spanish history, that this was a pretty federal place that had these deeply regional identities from long ago. Franco tries to suppress that and make everyone Castilian, but that's not what people wanted.
Aren't you impressed by the feistiness and the durability of these linguistic groups? They don't just roll over and teach their kids to speak the dominant language.
Well, Basque is a particularly extraordinary case, right? This survived, you know, the Roman Empire. It survived Ferdinand and Isabella. But similarly, the Celtic languages, whether it's Welsh or Irish or Scottish Gaelic, I mean, they have survived thousands of years.
Well, let's have a moment of silence for Cornish.
Oh, that's right, Cornish. Although there are people reviving it, actually, and Manx as well from the Isle of Man.
Is that right?
That language is another Celtic one being revived, so the story may not be over.
Well, Ireland has actually subsidized the survival of traditional Irish language on the West in Gaeltachts, national parks for the survival of the language, frankly.
That's what they are. And, you know, Ireland has had its independence now for a century. And, you know, I know many hoped for the language to be revived even more, but a whole new world of second language speakers has been created. Mm-hmm. Irish has a big place in, you know, the national culture. And those Gaeltachts in Western Ireland, I mean, they're some of the most extraordinary, beautiful, and culturally rich and interesting places around.
You know, that leads me to just wonder about the complexities and the disadvantages are the hardship caused by multilingual countries. I mean, Belgium is a good example. They have a hard time with it split between French-speaking Walloons and Dutch-speaking Flemish people, right?
It's interesting. I mean, you can look at a place like Belgium where, from what I understand, you know, there is some of that tension there, right? And some would say, you know, maybe that it will split up. You know, part of what I understand in Belgium was that it was the way that French was put on top that has led to some of the resentments and issues now. So but then you can look at a case like Switzerland, where it's very successfully multilingual, and it sort of depends on how you manage it. I think in and of itself, it's not necessarily a problem.
Ross, I just want to finish talking about the nonprofit organization that you are the co-director of, the Endangered Language Alliance. What is the mission of the Endangered Language Alliance, and what is its perspective on Europe?
So we're a unique organization based here in New York, founded in 2010. I tell the story of it in my book, Language City, which doubles as a linguistic history of New York. A lot of people forget about the European linguistic diversity in New York City, which has been here now for four centuries. And virtually every European language, including all these minority languages, has been spoken here, including all the ones we've mentioned. There's a church where the services are in Welsh. There's a Basque club. There's a Catalan literature festival. All of these languages are actually here. So in some ways, you know, if you can't get over to Europe at some point or you just want a taste of it and you're in New York, you can find it here.
Ross Perlin, thanks so much for joining us and best wishes with your work, inspiring and encouraging us to be a little more multilingual in our outlook.
Thank you very much, Rick.
Dr. Ross Perlin is the author of Language City, The Fight to Preserve Endangered Mother Tongues in New York. He's also written Intern Nation, How to Earn Nothing and Learn Little in the Brave New Economy. A list of Ross's upcoming appearances is on his website, rossperlin.com. Up next, travel host Onika Raymond shares what it's like to travel beyond your time zone and your comfort zone as a Black woman traveling solo. And listeners tell us how they've been avoiding the overcrowding of bucket list destinations to enjoy their own corners of Europe this year. It's Travel with Rick Steves. It's her goal to educate and encourage women to explore the world. Onika Raymond does that in her travel writing by hosting About the Journey on Apple Podcasts, in TV shows for the Travel Channel, and as a correspondent for CTV in Canada. Onika joins us from Miami today on Travel with Rick Steves to talk about her experience as a Black woman traveler and to inspire other women of color to join her in experiencing the many delights our world has to offer. Onika, it's nice to meet you.
Thank you so much for having me on the show, Rick.
You know, I have long wanted to have this topic, and you're the perfect guest because I'm really into travel. I really believe in the value of travel, and I'm a white male, and I'll never know what it's like to be a woman traveler, and I'll never know what it's like to be a Black traveler, and certainly not a Black woman traveler, and you are both, and you're on a mission to creatively inspire Black women to be confident on the road. You know, we have a pretty white industry when you look at it straight. And this is so important. And I'd like to just start out by asking you, what would you like me to appreciate about this subject?
Thank you so much for even opening the conversation. I think that's really something that's important to note, because I do think that when you're in a position of being the mainstream or when you're in a position of being the status quo, it is so easy to close your eyes to other people's experiences. And it's not even necessarily malicious. It's just the way things are. We are highly individualistic. We think of ourselves, and it's difficult for us to put ourselves in the shoes of others, especially when our needs are being catered to, because we do comprise the status quo. Mm-hmm. So I think more than anything else, I think it's just really important to acknowledge that there are differences for women like myself, Black women like myself, and other people of color who travel the world. We travel differently. Doesn't mean that it's any less fun. Doesn't mean that it's any less transformative. But there are different issues, topics, things that we have to navigate in order to have not only an enjoyable time on the road, but also a safe time on the road.
Are you more comfortable? Because the world is Black, brown, white, and you go to a different continent, a different corner, and there's different dominant cultures.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I've traveled in places where I feel like the minority, but
yes.
Generally I go to places that are mostly white, and that's kind of Europe and North America. But if you travel in a place that's mostly white, it's a different experience for you than in a place that's mostly Black, isn't it?
Well, sure. I mean, look, I think any Black person or person of color who's grown up, who's been born, raised, or lived a significant portion of their life in Europe or in the United States or in Canada, I mean, you're kind of used to navigating spaces that are very white. Mm-hmm. I know that for myself, I was born and raised in Toronto, Canada, which is a very multicultural city. But right. Canada on the whole is a very white country. And so I grew up having to navigate issues of race and culture and diversity, and having kind of a multiplicity of cultural background. You know, my family is from the Caribbean. My family mm-hmm. is Jamaican. Mm-hmm. I grew up in a very Jamaican household. And having that sometimes be at odds with my Canadian identity. But with that being said, I do feel as though it's a really beautiful thing to travel to places where people look like me, where I don't have anybody asking me questions about my skin color or my hair. There's a certain, I guess, cultural fluency and fluidity that comes with traveling to places where people or where folks look like you.
So maybe that would be a more relaxing vacation.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think I absolutely enjoy traveling back to the West Indies, where my family is from, traveling to the continent of Africa. I mean, that's a beautiful thing. Or even traveling some places in Europe where we have very large populations, very large Black populations, like France, for instance. I love going to Paris because not only do I get that stereotypical French culture, but then I'm also able to engage with the, I guess, also French culture, but the Afro-French culture, which I think is so rich and so wonderful.
Oh, yeah. And that's something that white travelers may be oblivious to, is the richness
yeah,
of
oblivious
the
Black African, and
Black
if,
French culture.
If they're not, exactly, and if they're not oblivious to it, they may be intimidated by it, because so often we reduce destinations to, I guess, a single story.
Right. And that's changing a lot now. Because
it's definitely changing a lot.
You're pretty much not getting it if you go to Lisbon and you think it's a bunch of white people.
Yeah, definitely. And I love that. And I think that's where social media has played such a large role in opening up the world for people. And, you know, I'm an older millennial. You know, I'm in my 40s now. And I remember when I first started traveling 20 odd years ago, there was no Instagram. I mean, Facebook didn't even exist at the time. I went to France in 2003, sight unseen. I crossed the Atlantic for the first time and lived for a year in France. In fact, there were no smartphones. I used a phone card and went down to a phone booth to call my family. And I only spoke to them maybe like once a week or once every 2 weeks. So it was a very, very different time. I didn't know. You know, we were kind of going into the void a lot of the time.
Yeah.
And so now we live in a different time, and you can go onto Instagram and you can see that, yes, Lisbon, of all places, is a very multicultural place mm-hmm. and one where a variety of races and cultures and religions coexist.
And that's changed a lot in one generation, especially in predominantly white corners of a continent like Europe. And the world, even in countries that are just so homogenous, is getting mixed up and made more interesting and more vibrant. I think in general, wouldn't you say people are welcoming that and celebrating that?
Oh, definitely. definitely. I think we are seeing, I guess, what would equate to kind of like a cultural mashup, right?
Yeah.
Where we
are
really seeing, you know, we see it in Europe, for instance, where the countries are so small, the distances between countries and borders and cities are so small that obviously as we have more and more people moving there, more people, you know, really integrating themselves. We're seeing more, I guess, mixes even racially, right? Intercultural and interracial relationships. We're seeing all this intermingling of colors and, you know, literally and figuratively, right? And nationalities and languages. And it's a beautiful thing because I think it just makes everybody a little bit more open and hopefully a little bit more tolerant. So there are none of these surprises or these shocks. You know, something that I've said in the past, which I've said it kind of tongue in cheek, but in a way it's kind of true and it's really resonated with a lot of the people who read my stuff or who follow me online, is basically anywhere you travel in any corner of the world, you are sure to find a Chinese person, somebody who's Dutch, and a Nigerian. I swear to you, you could go to the farthest reaches of Russia and you will find each one of those nationalities. And I think that just really speaks to how people are just moving and claiming the world, making the world their oyster. Mm-hmm. They are migrating to different places for additional opportunities, and they're just doing it. You know, there are not as many barriers as they were before.
No,
it is not as strange or as novel as it was in the past. And now people are everywhere and exploring and living and enjoying themselves as they see fit in different places.
This is Travel with Rick Steves. We're talking with travel journalist Onika Raymond, and she's joining us from Miami right now to share her perspective as a Black woman who loves to travel and why she's dedicated so much for travel writing and teaching to inspire other Black women to be comfortable on the road. She's the host of the podcast About the Journey. You can also find Onika on the Travel Channel as the host of a show called Big City, Little Budget and another show called One Bag and You're Out. Her website is onikaraymond.com. That's spelled O-N-E-I-K-A, onikaraymond.com. Onika, I was enjoying your website, and there's lots of information there. And you talked about two things as a Black woman on the road, the celebrity treatment and being profiled.
Yes.
That's kind of like...
Two ends of the spectrum.
Two ends of the spectrum, yeah. Talk a little bit about the serious issue of being profiled. As a white person, I wonder what could be the downside. And I mean, pretty clearly, it's hard to imagine the indignity of being profiled. What's that like? What kind of an issue is that? And then what about the celebrity thing?
I try to travel the world without fear. I try to travel the world with an open mind. But at the end of the day, I can't control the way I am perceived. And there are certain historical and political things, incidents that make it such that as a Black woman, as somebody who is visibly Black, who presents, you know, I mean, I wear a head wrap a lot of the time. In the past, I've worn dreadlocks. I've worn my hair in dreadlocks. I currently wear braids. You know, people have a certain idea in their mind of who I am, where I'm from, and what my intentions are. And to their eyes, to their mind, I present a threat. And so I absolutely have been profiled going through immigration. I've had people ask or officials ask for my passport, trying to ensure that I have the proper documentation to enter into a country, whereas
scrutiny
my other companions.
Yeah,
treatment that you wouldn't get. So my other, you know, if I'm traveling with somebody who is white and particularly a white male, they aren't getting that treatment. They aren't getting that scrutiny. And that's the type of place that we live in, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. That's the world that we live in. And so that's really something that I don't want Black people in particular to harp on that. I don't want it for them to be a deterrent to travel, but I absolutely do want them to be aware of it, and I do want them to be equipped to deal with
now,
it.
Now, Onika, you talked about presenting as a Black person.
Yes.
With a wrap and your hairstyle and so on.
Mm-hmm.
There are certain countries, if you're a gay person, you would not want to present as a gay person unless you're really on a crusade to make that clear, because it's dangerous.
Well, here's the thing. Something that I always say with whether it's sexual orientation or whether it's religion, by and large, a lot of the times there aren't necessarily physical expressions of that. As a dark-skinned black woman, there's no – I'm not fooling anybody.
I am not fooling anybody.
I present the way that I present with my African features, my wide nose, my crinkly hair, my – mahogany skin tone, and I love it. I own it 100%.
You own it. I was just going to say you own it. You've got pride and confidence
exactly.
in your step, and I would think that's kind of a travel skill if you are a person that is wondering, will I be comfortable?
Oh my gosh. Oh my goodness. Absolutely. It definitely does help to be confident in yourself and to walk with purpose and to take up space. And that's the way that I have decided to live my life. And that's why I really want to, particularly with my travel stories, I always want to make sure that I am empowering people.
Yeah, you're doing a service to other people by owning it and embracing it.
I hope so. I think that leading by example is really, really important. And being a visibly black woman, dark-skinned woman, and just going about the world and making it her oyster, I think that that's really significant.
And then you can get more of that celebrity treatment. Tell me about the celebrity treatment.
Well, that's definitely one of the positive aspects of traveling while black is getting noticed and having a lot of praise kind of heaped upon you. I've had people call me Beyonce. I look nothing like Beyonce. I would love to look like Beyonce, but I look nothing like her. I've had people call me Michelle Obama. I've had people offer to buy me drinks, just lots of special treatment. Yeah. And so that's something that I always try to share with others, particularly black women, is that, you know, that's the other side of the coin. You'll get noticed, but a lot of it is filled with positive affirmations.
Yeah. This is Travel with Rick Steves, and we're talking with travel journalist Onika Raymond. She's dedicated so much of her travel writing and teaching to inspiring other black women to be comfortable on the road. She's the host of the podcast About the Journey, and you can see her on the Travel Channel. She's the host of Big City, Little Budget, and also One Bag and You're Out. Her website is onikaraymond.com. Onika, you know, I would think that you being a teacher and you being somebody so committed to this idea, you're sort of a role model on the road for younger black people, I would think, looking up to you and thinking, yeah, this is how we can do it. What sort of responsibilities do you feel as a thought leader in this subject?
Well, you know, thank you so much for saying that. I come from an education background. I was a classroom teacher for over 10 years. I have my master's in education. I worked with young children, 6th grade through 12th grade. So I don't take my role as a role model lightly. Mm-hmm. And I take it on with pride. I take it on with aplomb because I feel as though it's really an opportunity to serve and to lead and to help these people navigate places, spaces, destinations that for them are just intimidating.
Right. And you're a leader in that area that people can emulate, that can be inspired by. There's not a lot of voices doing what you're doing, and there's a lot of people that can benefit from that encouragement and that inspiration, I think.
I appreciate that. And I think that my goal was never to be one of one or to be one of few. Mm-hmm. My goal is to continue to create content, educational content for black people such that there's no longer a need for it.
Onika, you're able to gallivant around the world and make the world your playground, and you've done a great job at it. How does that factor into your teaching? Because a lot of people who would look up to you as a leader and a black voice in the media will never see their name on a plane ticket.
That is something that I do grapple with. It's something that I acknowledge and recognize, particularly having come from an immigrant background myself. Mm-hmm. I have a Canadian passport. I have a U.S. green card. A lot of my family don't have that. They are Jamaican. They come from an island and they have a passport where even to travel to the United States or Canada, they need a travel visa. They need to provide proof of finances. They need to have all of this additional documentation to be permitted to travel, to leave the island and to go somewhere else. And that is the case for so many people. So there's something to be said about passport privilege. Mm-hmm. And I think what I endeavor to do more than anything else is to show people that you know, what exists in the world, what is possible for them, and then to give them the tools to figure out how they can make that happen for themselves, whatever their nationality is or where they find themselves.
It's been so great talking to you again. Your website is onikaraymond.com. The podcast is About the Journey. Onika, if you could just give a parting message, what would you like our white traveling audience to take away from your teaching? And what would you like your black audience to take away?
You know, I would tell everybody to just go, buy the ticket first and worry about the logistics later. And then I would encourage everybody to practice empathy. The world can be your oyster, but I think it's really important for all of us to be a good neighbor as we make the world our oyster and as we navigate all these different places, spaces, and destinations. So your fellow man, whether he's a different color, nationality, or whether he speaks a different language from you, is indeed a human just like yourself. And we should treat each other respectfully and with tolerance.
The more we know each other, the more we can be good neighbors.
Exactly, exactly. Just move with joy and move with love. I think that's my greatest hope for everyone.
All right. Onika Raymond, words of wisdom from the road. Thanks so much and happy travels to you.
Thanks for having me.
Onika Raymond shares tips and opinions to help you explore your own relationship with the world. You'll find her articles and blog posts from visiting six continents at onikathetraveler.com. Onika also lets us in on the nod you may observe among fellow travelers. You can hear about that in a website extra from today's interview. That's at ricksteves.com/radio. Next, we're checking with you, our listeners, at 877-333-7425. We're eager to hear how you're navigating around long lines and crowds at the places you want to visit in Europe. It's Travel with Rick Steves. You may have noticed a theme popping up in the last couple of years when we talk about popular tourism destinations. Some of them have simply become a bit too popular and are overcrowded and take a bit more effort to enjoy. So we've put out an invitation to our Travel with Rick Steves listeners to tell us how they find relief from the stress of too many people all wanting to see the same sights. They've emailed their tales and advice to us at radio@ricksteves.com. And our phone number is 877-333-RICK. Michael's calling in from Pine in Arizona. Hey, Michael, thanks for your call.
Oh, thank you for taking my call. Appreciate it.
Yeah, we're talking about crowds and how that has been a part of our travels. What have you done to avoid the crowds?
Well, we took your backdoor philosophy to heart. And my wife and I decided 30 years ago to go to Europe to meet the people, not necessarily to see all the sights. So our top priority is not to beat the crowd, but we eliminate the crowd. So we forego a lot of the major sites. So we haven't been to Paris to see the Eiffel Tower or Rome to see the Colosseum. But we haven't created some of the most lasting memories I think anybody has ever experienced. For example, we have shared recess with 9 students from a one-room school in Switzerland.
Wow.
We have helped 3 generations of an Austrian family move their cows from the pasture to the barn. We've watched a Black Forest farm host bake 28 loaves of bread in a wood-fired oven. In Norway, we were able to find a World War II German coastal fort that was completely deserted. We were the only people there, you know, nosing around to look at this thing. And in the same light, we found a Swiss Army training tank ground where we could peek in the windows at the tanks inside the tank sheds. Again, we were all by ourselves.
Michael, these are all good examples. Wow. These are examples of not having a bucket list. You know, you started out by saying, we haven't done the Eiffel Tower, the Colosseum. You know, those are a little, those are bucket list. Check it off. You've seen it. Yeah, it's great. But each one of those things that you just mentioned, those are the intimate memories. Those really are the most lasting memories, aren't they?
Yeah, exactly. And it's a trade-off. So, you know, this style of travel is not for everybody. But for us, anyway, it is much more meaningful. We get to know the people. As you say, we go close to the ground.
Right.
And we stay on farms. And we stay in one-bedroom apartments with a kitchen, which helps us do two things. We can go to the local grocery store, where we, again, rub elbows with the local people and buy the food that they buy. And it's much more inexpensive than constantly eating in restaurants. So we can travel at a much lower rate, and then we can travel more often.
And it's all carbonated by the people you meet and the experiences that those give you. I mean, that what you're saying is a travel skill, is how to travel in a way that opens you up to these connections with people. And if you're staying in a fancy hotel, you know, you're going to have a friendly welcome, but it's all angling for a tip, you know, to carry your bag to your room or something like that. But if you're staying in an apartment and going to the corner grocery store and talking to the cheesemonger about what cheese you should have and picnicking in the park, that's where you're going to meet people. And you know, if that's your agenda is to create those memories, it can be done. It's very rewarding, I think.
Nobody can guarantee that you'll have these memories, because a lot of them are serendipity. In fact, we're so excited about this mode of travel as we've created a free website where we try and encourage people to consider it as an important option for independent travel.
That's great. You have a website for this?
Yes, it's europescountryroads.com.
I understand you were looking for a non-touristy alternative to Rotenburg, because Rotenburg's got to be the most touristy city in Germany. I love it, but boy, it is built for tourists. If the tourism economy was gone, that city would have almost nothing.
Yeah, we love it too, but we found an alternative called Machmühl, and it's a walled city with a castle, and it's entirely if you see tourists there, they're likely to be Germans.
Michael, I spent years looking for the, quote, untouristy Rotenburg, and I never found it. And you have Machmühl, Mockmuhl. I'm going to put that on my list.
Yeah, umlauts on the O and on the U.
Okay, so you got your double umlauts in that word, Mockmühl.
Yeah.
All right.
And we go to Swabia is almost tourist-free. So in between the Black Forest and Bavaria is a district called Swabia.
Uh-huh.
And they boast that they have more castles and castle ruins than any other place in Germany.
Swabia. Very good. Well, Michael, thank you for your call. This has really been an inspiration, just to think that you've sort of amped up your travel experiences by focusing on those special moments. Thanks, Michael. Happy travels.
You too.
This is Travel with Rick Steves. Our phone number is 877-333-7425. You can email us at radio@ricksteves.com. In fact, Craig in Vancouver, BC emailed us, and he writes, "Sidle up to the bar and get a pint in the neighborhood pub in London. Grab a glass of wine and a cicchetti and stand at the corner of one of the little bars in Venice. Join a raucous shared table at a beer garden in Munich and just talk to the people. You'll get all sorts of insights into hidden gems that locals have discovered." Craig, that is great advice. And wherever you're traveling, you can get a drink with the locals and use that as an excuse to talk to the people. And, I love to go to a university town, find out where the students are hanging out, and buy the table a round of spritzes. And then you are suddenly the most popular kid on the block, and you've got a lot of friends. One way or another, meet the people. Andrew's calling in from Trainer, Iowa. Hey, Andrew, thanks for your call.
Hi, Rick. How are you?
Doing good. How's your travels been lately when it considers crowds and avoiding them?
Well, I think like a lot of people, they're getting busier and busier. But one secret I've found is to hit the less touristy areas and I had one place in mind that I wanted to see if you've ever visited. So in 2018, a group of friends and I went from Amsterdam to Berlin, which are obviously very popular places. But on the way, we stopped in this area called the Harz Mountains.
Oh, yeah.
And it was really incredible. Very quaint, very picturesque, but you could tell they were not accustomed to American travelers, which we thought was a good thing. It felt very authentic. And I was wondering if you've ever been there and if it's a place that you would recommend to fellow travelers.
You know, the Harz Mountains are in northern Germany, aren't they? And
yes. They're
up sort of on the way to Berlin in the north. And I've been there a couple of times. The fact is, Americans just are not inclined to go to that part of Germany. We all want to go on the Rhine River and the Romantic Road and Bavaria and Munich, and, you know, understandably so. But the Germans and a lot of people who know a good place for a vacation, they really enjoy the Harz Mountains. It's famous because that's where the Pied Piper of Hamelin was. But I can't even think of an American I've met that's reported on the Harz Mountains. It's just not something Americans tend to do. Germany is an interesting case that way because after World War II, it was divided into four zones, I think French, British, Russian, and American. All of our German travel dreams are set in the American sector, which is Bavaria, the south of Germany. That's where our image of lederhosen and clinking mugs of beer and oompah bands and stuff, that's pretty much Bavarian more than German,
right. But
we think of that as German, don't we?
Right. This area, I believe it was actually part of the eastern Germany, is that right?
I think it was, yeah. That was what we think of as eastern Germany. That was the Soviet sector, yeah. And Berlin
right. Was
a little island of the West embedded in Soviet East Germany.
One of the things I found really interesting is this town, Wernigerode, where we stayed. I think it's actually pronounced Wernigerode. You take a train up to the Brocken, which is the tallest part of the Harz Mountains. And it's a pretty popular thing to do.
Yeah.
I think maybe because there's not a ton to do.
Yeah.
Other than see old buildings and castles and whatnot. But just a really fascinating area, and I thought it would be worth mentioning in case anybody in your show or anybody that would listen might have interest in a less touristy area of Germany.
You know, I think that there's something to be said, even if it doesn't have the razzle-dazzle sights, you know, it doesn't have Neuschwanstein or you know, something that we might all want to go see, just to be in a place that's beautiful and charming and well-preserved and filled with German vacationers, perhaps, but without any Americans or without any international travelers, that's a delightful experience. And I would say the Harz Mountains, I believe it's spelled H-A-R-Z, and the Harz Mountains are just a great example of that. In a lot of ways, former Eastern Germany, the DDR, was kind of in a sort of mothballed and didn't change that much during the Cold War. And then after Germany was reunited, they had to scramble to get the infrastructure and the affluence and the efficiency that the West has been known for. But a lot of that old, charming, small-town, half-timbered quaintness survives in that part of Germany. I'll be traveling in a few weeks into a region called the Valley of the Clueless. And it was a part of eastern Germany that did not get radio or TV reception from the West, so they didn't really know what was going on in the West, like some of the towns on the border that could be connected by the West through media, even when that was supposedly forbidden, you know, or foreboding.
Interesting.
Yeah. But it's a good tip, Andrew. And I hope that do you have any good travels coming up?
I might be going to Utrecht to visit my sister here in April next year.
Ah, Utrecht.
So that's the goal with my two toddlers.
I think there's a wonderful open-air folk museum near Utrecht at Arnhem that you might want to go, especially if you're traveling with kids.
Yes, it
brings
absolutely
all of the traditions of the Netherlands together in this one beautiful folk park.
I will definitely check that out. Thank you for the recommendation.
All right, Andrew. Thanks for calling in. Take care.
Bye.
You can hear from more of our Travel with Rick Steves listeners in part one to this topic of getting beyond tourist sites in Europe that have gotten a bit overcrowded lately. Those conversations aired in August on program number 763. Listen from our show archives at ricksteves.com/radio. And Ginger in Redlands, California has another great example of how a smart traveler can avoid the crowds. Ginger writes, "We went to the Acropolis and the Parthenon in Athens. To beat the crowds, we got in line at the back entrance at 7:30 a.m., 30 minutes before they opened their doors. By 7:50, the line behind us snaked beyond where we could see. When the doors opened,
We walked and climbed as quickly as we could to the top and enjoyed a beautiful, magical moment where we were all alone on the Acropolis in Athens. Such a great example, Ginger, of how all of us need to be thoughtful about being at those popular places when they're not so popular. Dusty from Honolulu emailed us, and Dusty writes, "The island nation of Malta in the middle of the Mediterranean is part of the European Union and an ideal backdoor. They have 365 churches that really come alive during religious festivals, which are almost weekly. Try going during St. Joseph's Day or Palm Sunday or some other time that's not in peak season. You'll experience local culture coming alive. Processions can have as many as 500 locals in costumes participating, and each village rivals each other. Mostas Cathedral is one of the largest unsupported domes in the world, with a World War II shelter that's a museum today. The three islands of Malta also include Blue Lagoon beaches and medieval towns like Rabat and Medina, which blend Eastern, Western, and North African styles." Wow, Dusty sounds like he's on the tourist promotion board of the island nation of Malta. That sounds really good. And it's an island that a lot of people have one-day stop when they're on a cruise ship. It's a huge cruise port. It's an island that's very easy to access from different points around Mediterranean Europe. And it is an island that I was impressed by the fortifications. It's just a totally fortified island in the middle of the Mediterranean there, sort of indicating it's had a hard-fought history and reminding us of its strategic importance. Great to hear from Dusty about all the things you can see and do on that little tiny country in the middle of the Mediterranean, Malta. Alice is on the line from St. George in Utah. Alice, thanks for your call.
Yeah, hi, Rick. Thanks for taking my call. Yeah, I found that going like for the Christmas markets off-season, there's nothing other than the Christmas markets themselves that are crowded at all. You know, theme parks, boat rides, tours, museums, nothing.
So all the people visiting Nuremberg during the Christmas festival, for example, Christmas market, will be focused on the festivities around that market scene, leaving the rest of the sites that are worthwhile all year long less crowded
Absolutely.
Than normal?
Absolutely. I walked right up to the castle and almost nobody up there. Free rein.
That's good advice. Everybody's on the main square enjoying. You're going to enjoy the festival, but the Christmas market, but don't neglect what the city is known for 365 days out of the year.
Exactly. And like I said, no wait. So, best time to go.
So when were you there?
I was there last Christmas, and I'm going back again. Actually, I went to the Christmas markets like last two years.
Really?
And I'm going back again.
Alice, where have you seen Christmas markets in Europe?
Well, mostly in Germany. Mm-hmm. And then I went up, over in Paris, of course, but mostly in Germany, and went into Salzburg from Munich.
So how are they different? I'm curious about that. What distinguishes
them? Well, the funny thing is the German ones really aren't really that different. You know, maybe a few little regional things, but, you find the more differences in the different countries. Like the Nuremberger sausages or something, but really not a lot different. All the merchandise is, substantially the same. So
Nuremberg sausage. I love a Nuremberg sausage. Did you eat the Nuremberg sausages?
Yes, I did. I always try to get the specialty, yeah.
Oh, I love it. Three, the size of your little finger. Three of them on a little bun with some nice mustard. Oh, baby.
I even saw the Christkind. She just happened to be there when
I was you saw the Christkind. Tell us about the Christkind. What was that like? Who is she, first of all?
It was interesting. Well, it was packed, obviously, and she was trying to, pay attention to the kids. But it was just interesting after seeing her on the TV show and getting to see her in person.
Oh, that's great. The Christkind, by the way, for our listeners, is the celebrity of the Christmas season in Bavaria, in Nuremberg, I think, especially. And she's a teenage girl that's chosen to be like the angel. It's called the Christ child, Christkind. But it's a young girl who really is the gift giver for all the gifts. And sort of the little children are enamored by her, aren't they?
Yes, they were. And she really played to them also,
It was amazing, phenomenal for me to see this Christkind in action. And I'll never forget, she'd hold an audience with all the little kids looking up at her like she was just a gift from heaven. And she said, "If you're very gentle, you can touch my wings." I'll never forget that. "If you're very gentle, you can touch my wings." And then all the kids came up and got to touch her wings.
And I've also noticed, like I said, not just museums, which are empty, but like the TV tower in Munich, boat tours in Berlin, the theme park at Europa Park.
Yeah.
You could even just walk right in. I've never walked into a theme park, you know, without any wait. And they let you just stay on the ride if you liked it. You didn't have to get off and go through again.
They're that empty because it just sucks all the travel oxygen out of the city. Everything's on the main square for that.
Oh, yeah.
Christmas
it's elbow
market.
To elbow at the Christmas yeah. markets, you know.
So what's a highlight for you? Because I'm fascinated by people who just, they go back year after year for the Christmas markets. What is it about it? Is it the hot spiced wine? Is it the little family scenes? Is it the craftsmanship and the loving artisan work? What is it about these Christmas markets?
Oh, that's a really interesting question, because I try to, like I said, squeeze in some other sites. But I find that as opposed to just going museum after museum, you know, on a kamikaze tour, it's just kind of relaxing. You know, you have a little snack.
Yeah.
Your people watch. You get something, you know, different that you're not going to get here in America
yeah.
to eat.
Yeah.
You know, and then you throw in a site or a tour.
Yeah.
You know.
And it's people. I think it's a community coming together. It's just a, like we have a county fair here, you know, outside of Seattle. And it's just half of the fun is people watching, all the families that are there and all the traditions. And that's the same thing at a Christmas market anywhere in Germany.
Absolutely.
Alice, thanks for your call and have fun at your next Christmas market.
Thank you, Rick. Bye-bye.
Take care.
Travel with Rick Steves is produced at Rick Steves Europe in Edmonds, Washington by Tim Tatton, Kazmara Hall, and Donna Bardsley. Andrew Wakeling and Sherry Court upload the shows to our website. Our theme music was written and performed by Jerry Frank. Affiliate relations are by Sheila Gerzoff. You can find links to our guests and search the show archives at ricksteves.com/radio. We'll see you next week with more Travel with Rick Steves.
My Facebook friends are a fun community of curious travelers, and you're invited to join in. To stow away with me in my work, play, politics, philanthropy, and travels, follow me at Rick Steves on Facebook.